Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp. I've returned to the Native American Studies channel for the New Books Network. Today, we have Assistant Professor of History at Utah State University, Seth Archer. He's here with us today to discuss his new book, Sharks Upon the Land, Colonialism, Indigenous Health, and Culture in Hawaii, 1778 to 1855. Welcome, Professor Archer.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Just wanted to note, he was also previously a postdoc at Cambridge. So your new book is published this year by Cambridge University Press. Can you tell us a little bit about the cover, the striking cover of this man and this woman on your book?
Sure. This is an image I found in the archives in the Honolulu Museum of Art. Many illustrations by this French artist, Jacques Arago, have been published in the past, but not this one. And that's why I was so excited when I came across it. It shows a man facing a woman, and the woman holds a toddler to her breast. The man is wearing a British Navy coat with tails on it. I assume it's British Navy, a coat that's been traded to him. It's pretty tattered. It has the elbow ripped out and shows lots of signs of wear. And on the lower half of his body, he's wearing the traditional Hawaiian garment, the malo, which essentially looks like a G-string. On his legs, his legs are covered by tattoos. Many of them are traditional, but there's one that probably most people who look at this won't see, but I hope some will. On his right thigh, oriented up and down, is a rifle with a bayonet. And that is a trade item that was new to Hawaii after 1778 and which had an incredible impact, weapons on Hawaiian society. So it's a sign of the importance of that weapon to him. As for the woman, she's holding a toddler, as I mentioned, and fertility is a central theme of this book, and difficulties with growing with families and with reproduction because of the health struggles of the Hawaiian people. And so I speculate in the conclusion of this book, was this child hers? Was the child adopted, which is a really important cultural tradition in Polynesian societies, including Hawaiian society, close family adoption. But it's also, the image is also chosen to illustrate that despite an incredibly grim story in this book, Hawaiian people do recover. Their society does thrive after this story, just against all the odds, really. The Hawaiian population recovers and Hawaiian culture experiences a great renaissance in the 20th century. So it's a little bit of hope there on the cover, and as I say, in what is otherwise a pretty grim story.
So why title your book Sharks Upon the Land? How does the study push the field of native health history, according to you, beyond epidemiology and demography into the realm of indigenous cultural responses to changing health conditions? Also, if possible, can you comment on the wonderful appendices at the end of the book?
Sure. The title, Hawaiians traditionally had a term for their chiefs. Hawaiian society before the arrival of Europeans was strictly hierarchical, which some scholars who know Native North America better are sometimes surprised about the strict class hierarchy. But it was hierarchical, and the common Hawaiians referred to their chiefs. They had a term for them, which was the shark who travels on land. And what they meant by that essentially was that the chief would travel from district to district, island to island in some cases, and essentially co-opt the native agricultural productions, and not only tax the people, but as I say, co-opt their labor and their production. So it was as if the chief was a shark just coming on the land and devouring the crops and the produce that the people had labored over. So I use it as a metaphor in this book that, like those ravenous chiefs who traveled around the land, colonialism and the epidemiological and other incursions were like sharks as well upon the land. And I also wanted to call up the class dimension that remains an important feature of Hawaiian society in the midst of colonialism, that the impact on the common people is disproportionate and distinct from that of the chiefs, the impact of colonialism. And the class dimension really never goes away, at least throughout the period I'm studying. As for the quotation that you mentioned, yeah, I wanted this study to push beyond the epidemiological and demographic discussions in indigenous history. And what I mean by that essentially is from Alfred Crosby, the environmental historian Alfred Crosby, on through really the early 2000s, most of the discussion about native health, I'm thinking especially about North America and the Americas, has been about percentages, population loss, and the diseases that struck. So essentially, we're going to talk about smallpox or measles. We're going to chronicle the rate of depopulation. So a lot of demographers were doing this work, geographers, environmental historians. What I saw very little of when I began to research in this field was the cultural dimensions of that impact. So when a society or community loses 90% of its population, which unfortunately did happen among many indigenous communities, what does that mean culturally or socially? How does that affect religion? How does that affect gender relations? How does that affect trade and labor? So essentially, I was interested in the social and cultural dimensions of health struggles and of the disease impact in Native societies. And I chose Hawaii for a number of reasons. Probably the most important was the source base, the very rich documentary record and oral traditions that had been preserved in Hawaii. And then just lastly on the appendices, there are four appendices in the book. One is just a glossary of Hawaiian terms. The second is a list of selected persons who appear in the book, because for many readers, most readers, I would say, Hawaiian names are really difficult. And then finally, I have a pretty extensive population table, because the demographic story is an important story. And so I did my best to compile the statistics on every island and the overall Hawaiian population, the non-Hawaiian population, the part Hawaiian population over the course of a century from the 1770s to the 1870s. Finally, and it's actually the first appendix I worked on, I have an appendix of Hawaiian terms for venereal disease. And this is sexually transmitted infections, as we call them today. I noticed really early on in my research, and at the same time that I was trying to learn to read Hawaiian, I noticed that there were a huge number of terms for sexually transmitted infections. And I thought compiling a list might be revealing. And in fact, the language itself is revealing. There are social class dimensions to some of these terms, as well as abundant evidence of the effect of venereal disease on newborns and children. So I couldn't have discussed these subjects without the Hawaiian language itself. And so I have this extensive appendix with all the terms and the variants and their translations.
If possible, please elaborate on your source base, as well as your admission that while mindful of the warnings of post-structuralism and post-colonialism, I am less skeptical than some scholars about the ability of foreign observers and languages to illuminate developments in native society.
Sure. I've already suggested that the Hawaiian language has rich sources for this study, and as it does for any study on Hawaii and Hawaiian history. Hawaiian language sources, really, they're a unique documentary trove, possibly unparalleled by any indigenous people globally in the 19th century, certainly in the American sphere. I don't know of any indigenous language source base quite as rich. And there are various reasons for this. I don't think I have time to go into them, but they were extremely important to the study. And most people working in Hawaiian history now do use these sources and make the effort to learn the language, which is really, really important. But a lot depends on the questions being asked in terms of what sources a scholar uses. And the questions I was asking really did require the use of foreign documents. And the foreigners who visit Hawaii in this period are from all over the world. It's pretty shocking, actually. There are British, American, French, Spanish, Russian, German, Baltic German, Mexican, and Tahitian writers, all of whom record their experiences and observations on the Hawaiian Islands. And my gut feeling while starting this research was that the broadest possible source base would enable me to tell the most complete story. And I hope that's been the case. But let me just add that there's so much more in the Hawaiian language documents to be researched, to be explored. And so by no means did I exhaust what was there in the Hawaiian language sources. I just tried to get a cross-section of observers of Hawaiian health and colonialism in this period. And then finally, yeah, in terms of the skepticism about foreign observers and languages, what I found when I started reading sources from multiple nations and translated documents from the Russian and French and German was that these people, Europeans, mostly Europeans, were not of one mind. They were never of one mind, and their disagreements were illuminating. I was also able to triangulate certain social and cultural effects on the Hawaiian Islands and just plain epidemiological information because I would see it in multiple sources. And in many cases, I was surprised how many cases, these are the only documents that are out there that would illuminate something like the introduction of syphilis or the plummeting fertility rate in the early 19th century. The oral traditions, of course, they're out there, they exist, but they don't illuminate the way these foreign observers do the finer details, the finer points of some of these effects. So I was really grateful to have the broad source base.
Can you briefly elaborate on diseases endemic to the islands prior to 1778 and possible reasons for shortened lifespans?
Well, life was shorter everywhere in the 18th century, Europe, Asia, as it was in the Pacific. But the significant point here is that in Hawaii, there were few of what we call acute infectious diseases. So measles, smallpox, the sexually transmitted infections, whooping cough, influenza, these diseases did not, as far as we can tell, did not afflict Hawaiians before 1778. The diseases they did have were chronic inflammatory conditions, tooth decay, birth defects, complications in childbirth for women. And then archaeologists speculate about zoonotic diseases, in other words, diseases that spread from livestock. But there's a key difference here as well, because Hawaii did not have cows or goats or sheep. There were pigs and chickens and dogs. And so there's some work trying to sort out where human diseases spread from these livestock. But again, the key is that the acute infectious diseases were not present before Europeans arrived.
Why did Hawaiian women engage in sexual intercourse, for pleasure or otherwise, with Captain James Cook's sailors?
This is a fraught subject. Hawaiian women and some girls did engage in sexual intercourse with Captain Cook's men when they arrived in 1778. And this began a story or a rhetoric in European, in Western cultures, European and American society, about Pacific Islanders as sensual and exotic. We can see this clear through Paul Gauguin, his art, his painting, and Robert Louis Stevenson, and frankly, all the way through the 20th century with the spread of hula culture. But what I found actually is that sexual mores were quite varied around the Pacific. Some societies were very reticent to engage in sexual exchanges with newcomers. Most of these newcomers are Europeans. And other societies were less reticent. Hawaii in 1778 fits the latter description. And the reasons for sexual exchange are really complicated. I go on quite at length about this, and the scholarship before me has as well. But let me just mention a few factors that are important and relevant here. In these early exchanges between European sailors and Hawaiians, there was some coercion. Coercion frequently by Hawaiian kinspeople of the women who were engaging in sexual exchange, and sometimes by European sailors. It wasn't at the start. It wasn't a sex trade or prostitution. It was more of an exchange. So women were getting very useful tools, iron tools, looking glasses, textiles, clothing, luxury items as well, jewelry, and that sort of thing. There was a motivation there. But really, the most significant motivation for women to engage in sexual exchange with the newcomers, I'm following other scholars here, was the sense they had of the newcomers' mana. And mana is just the Hawaiian term for spiritual power. That the newcomers' technology, language, general exoticism suggested to Hawaiians that these people were interesting, special in some way, that they had certain powers. And Hawaiians were interested in investigating that power, that mana. And there's plenty of evidence that Hawaiian women and girls thought that engaging in sexual relations with these men would give them access to that power, possibly increase their status in Hawaiian society. The anthropological term is hypergamy. In other words, marrying up, increasing your status through connection to a higher status person. And so it took, as I describe in the book, it took a little bit of exploration, including spending a lot of time on the ships and trying to get to know these people, these men. They were all men, these newcomers. And part of that exploration and experimentation, for better or worse, involved sex. The reason it's so important for this book is that the first major diseases that strike Hawaii are sexually transmitted diseases. So the actual, for lack of a better term, the actual volume of sexual exchange that occurs early on in Hawaii affects Hawaiian health over the long term.
So I guess on that note, what diseases specifically resulted from this sexual exchange among these vulnerable Hawaiians? And how, in turn, did this exchange situate, and you're very careful to argue, not cause, but situate the violent crucible that precipitated the killing of Captain Cook in 1779?
Yeah, and let me just explain that term "vulnerable," which you put in quotes there, and for good reason. It's a loaded term, but in terms of the actual diseases that strike, which are gonorrhea, venereal syphilis, and tuberculosis, the Hawaiian people were vulnerable because those diseases were not present on the islands before 1778. And because they were not present, these acute infectious diseases have a way of being especially virulent when they're new among a population. So they struck with incredible force. So gonorrhea and syphilis are both bacterial diseases spread through sexual intercourse. Tuberculosis, which was the leading killer worldwide in the 19th century, is spread through the air, so through the breath and sneezing, coughing, that kind of thing. We know pretty certainly, well, I should just say certainly, that Captain Cook's men spread both gonorrhea and syphilis in 1778. And we know that because they stay for just a few weeks on the first voyage in January 1778. They return in November of that same year, and before they even come to shore on any island, Hawaiians come up to them on canoes and show them that they've been infected with sexually transmitted infections, both gonorrhea and syphilis. And Captain Cook and his men write extensively about this. There are eight published accounts and possibly more unpublished accounts by Cook's men. We have the names of sailors who violated Captain Cook's orders to stay away from native women, Hawaiian women. There were punishments dealt out on the deck of the ship for men who slept with Hawaiian women while being infected with these diseases. The Cook accounts actually describe this. So it's as conclusive as it possibly could be that Captain Cook's men, and I should note that it was not just sailors, it was also officers engaged in sexual relations with Hawaiian women. Tuberculosis, the third disease, is much harder to identify when exactly it spread, but there were various men on board the ship who were infected. One officer dies from tuberculosis on the way home. And one of the ways of greeting people on the Hawaiian Islands was to touch noses and exchange breath. Well, that's a very great way to spread tuberculosis. And sure enough, within a matter of years, the disease is present on the island. And so how did these new diseases situate but not cause the killing of Cook in the following year? Well, there's a lot of evidence in the Cook journals that people were very upset about having caught these sexually transmitted infections. They were distraught. They were looking for some solutions. They say Hawaiians tell the British in no uncertain terms that you gave us this disease, now fix it. Cook's men record Hawaiian people preparing herbal remedies and applying these remedies to their genitals to try to alleviate the pain and perhaps cure the venereal disease. And there's a substantial conversation about these diseases between the British and the Hawaiians. But there's also a whole lot else going on in Cook's second visit to the Hawaiian Islands in late 1778 into 1779, including, I argue, the British sailors' defiance of Hawaiian authority, specifically their defiance of Hawaiian kapus or restrictions on engaging in sex with Hawaiian women. So the British are assigned to an encampment on the Big Island of Hawaii in 1779 when they return from the North American, from the Pacific Northwest. They're assigned to a specific encampment, and the chiefs, or ali'i, on the Big Island, forbid them from leaving their encampment. Well, British sailors and officers defy this order. They seek out Native Hawaiian women, and the relations between the British and the Hawaiian chiefs on the Big Island take a negative turn as a result of this. So in the end, five British sailors are killed, including Captain Cook and 30 or more Hawaiians. And I argue that that British relations with Hawaiian women were a major part of this conflict. And of course, sex is a major part of relations between the sailors and the women.
What role did the memory of Kukulono play in the religious political dimensions of the devastation of the Ma'i Marihini?
Well, this is another contentious debate in Hawaiian history. The possibility that some Hawaiians on the Big Island may have seen Captain Cook as their returning agricultural deity, Lono. There was an extensive debate in the 1990s between an American anthropologist and a Sri Lankan anthropologist about this. But actually, Hawaiian historians, Native Hawaiian writers and historians throughout the 19th century stated pretty flatly that that people on the Big Island did see Captain Cook as a manifestation or the actual agricultural deity Lono having returned in a kind of messiah way of returning. And there are a lot of complicated reasons for this. The season in which he arrives, the way Cook's ships circumnavigate the islands, the sails that bear some resemblance to the ritual streamers of the Lono cult used. And so there was a lot of heated debate about whether this was a possibility that Captain Cook could be seen as a god. And the term god is not so helpful once you understand Hawaiian religion a little bit better, because it doesn't translate into Western concepts very well. But in any case, after Cook is killed in the skirmish on the Big Island in 1779, a lot of people start to ask the British stick around for a while, and then in the years that follow, many more British come, and a lot of Hawaiians on the Big Island begin asking the British when Cook Lono would return. And they also, more interesting to me, they suggest that his death was somehow related to the Ma'i Malihini, in other words, the introduced diseases that the British saddled Hawaiians with. Stories also circulate about Cook's potential role in a volcano eruption on the Big Island. So it seems pretty clear to me that at least some islanders on the Big Island are associating the Cook event with their own religious traditions, and especially with traditions about this agricultural deity Lono. What hasn't been explored as much, and what I contribute in this chapter, is their connection of Cook and his men with the introduced diseases. And so that's what I try to explore in this section of the chapter.
In the late 1780s and early 1790s, why and how did Hawaiian women relate important information about the attentions to British traders? And how did the ensuing arms trade and spread of tuberculosis affect, or shape, relations between George Vancouver and Kamehameha?
Well, what happens after the Cook expedition is a series of European and American explorers and fur traders, Pacific fur traders, arrive at the islands. They're mostly stopping there as a way station, gathering food and fresh water, and then carrying on. So many of these visits are relatively short. But the sexual exchanges that I described in the first chapter that began immediately with the arrival of Cook, they develop into a more formal sex trade. So many women and girls, there may well have been men as well, but it's not recorded because same-sex relations between men were a capital offense in most European navies, so they're not going to write that down. But many women and girls are wrangled into, as I say, a more formal sex trade with European sailors. And some women, I was surprised to find, were eager to use European men as bargaining chips. And what I mean by that is that, like many societies in Hawaii, in late 18th century Hawaii, the authority of various leaders was challenged, was contested. And so Hawaiian females, as I say, both women and girls, were canny and willing to try to play these newcomers off of their own chiefs. So women, again, this was a surprise to me, stayed aboard European ships for weeks at a time. This occurs in throughout the 1790s and the early 19th century. Even when Europeans and Americans are skirmishing, having military engagements with Hawaiian forces, Hawaiian women remain on the ships. And what they're doing on the ships besides sex, I suppose, is anyone's guess. There maybe could be more research here, but they are building alliances. I can't think of a better term than alliance. What the alliance consists of, you know, how far it could be stretched. Again, we know very little about this, but Hawaiian women are spending a lot of time on these European and American ships. And so I try to track these exchanges and make sense of what could be happening there. The other thing that happens, you asked about tuberculosis. Yeah, tuberculosis is critical to the story of colonialism in Hawaii. It's been underestimated, I argue. And what it does specifically at this moment is it takes the lives of two or more chiefs on the island of Maui, which enables a big island chief by the name of Kamehameha to conquer Maui. So I argue it plays a really important role. Kamehameha will then go on to conquer the entire island chain over the course of a few decades. But the conquest of Maui was an important first step for him, and really, really secures his place as a crucial leader. George Vancouver is the second major British expedition, the Vancouver Expedition, to deal with Hawaiians. They make three separate trips and spend an awful lot of time there. Vancouver is less observant than Captain Cook. Less observant and less interested in culture and Hawaiian culture and society. What he really wants is to take Hawaii as a protectorate and add it to the British Empire. So he's focused on finding the right people to deal with and shore up support for British rule, essentially. That does not happen, but what does happen is Vancouver's men help Kamehameha to build a warship. They're reluctant to trade weapons because warfare, internecine warfare, has already broken out on the islands in the wake of Captain Cook. But they do give him provide a warship, which Kamehameha will find very useful in the coming decades as he's trying to conquer the remaining islands. I should have noted that the Hawaiian Islands, despite being a relatively small kind of a postage stamp there in the middle of the Pacific, there were four separate polities, at least four, possibly five, when Captain Cook arrived. So Kamehameha was the first Hawaiian chief to try to consolidate and essentially create a kingdom. That's what he did of all eight islands. And then one final note here that from the Hawaiian perspective, this period, besides the impact of foreign diseases and the outbreak of warfare, I describe it as a scramble for new knowledge, technology, and diplomatic relations. That's what not only Kamehameha, but other elite Hawaiians, chiefs, but also common people are trying to figure out how to negotiate all these newcomers from all these different nations and trying to incorporate various technologies and trying to get diplomacy underway.
Can you explain the causes and progression of the squatting sickness that engulfed 1804 Hawaii, as well as its consequences for kahuna practices? What were the roles of foreign physicians?
Well, as Kamehameha begins his conquest of the islands, he starts with Maui, as I mentioned, and then he gets to Oahu, which is where Honolulu is. And he's got three major islands, maybe four at that point. And he's begun planning in around 1803 for a conquest of the remaining islands, especially Kauai and Niihau, which are the westernmost Hawaiian islands, and are strictly independent. They're an independent polity at this time. He's been trying for at least 10 years by this point to conquer Kauai and Niihau. And so what he does is deploys about 7,000 Hawaiian soldiers, as well as 50 foreigners to set up on the Honolulu shorefront and get ready for a voyage up to Kauai and Niihau to conquer those islands. Unfortunately for Kamehameha, a bacterial infection breaks out among his men who are in camp. We don't know whether this was dysentery or some kind of cholera, but it was. We do know that it was among probably the three worst epidemics in recorded Hawaiian history. So something on the range of 5,000 to 15,000 people may have been struck down on the island of Oahu because of this sickness. It was called oku'u, which means squatting sickness, which points to the gastrointestinal dimension of the illness. So diarrhea doesn't tend to kill people very very often in the West today, but back then it certainly did, and so the fatalities were striking. The other significant aspect of this disease, besides the fact that it stopped Kamehameha in his tracks, he literally turned back, went back to the Big Island, and the conquest of Kauai and Niihau was put on hold, specifically because of this epidemic. But the other important aspect is that the differential effects of disease outbreak between Hawaiians and newcomers by now had become clear. So if people hadn't noticed earlier that syphilis and gonorrhea and tuberculosis seemed to be striking the islanders at a disproportionate rate to the newcomers, now it began to look more clear that there was a differential impact for these new and foreign diseases. Foreigners were still in very small numbers, permanent residents that were very low numbers at this time. There were only a few hundred probably by 1804, maybe less than that. But the islanders did start to recognize differences in effect. And so they began to think about, okay, maybe our medicine needs to be reformed. Maybe our medicine needs to account for these new illnesses. Some speculated, well, they're foreign illnesses. And so really what we need is foreign medicine. Western physicians need to treat these Western diseases. And others argued, the kahuna order, the order of physicians, simply needed to innovate with new remedies and preventions. And so the documentary record on this reform effort is very thin and really needs more work, I think, by other scholars. But there are some indications that new training began to take place and possibly new methods among the kahuna, the medical practitioners on the islands. But at the exact same time that that was happening, foreign physicians began to get entangled in Hawaiian politics. And I think this was this is a subject that hadn't been discussed by other scholars. And I found it very interesting that any large expedition, even a decent-sized trading ship, would have a surgeon or some kind of medical specialist on board. And these people, these foreign physicians, were very quickly found it very easy to get ingratiated with Hawaiian chiefs, for the simple reason that Hawaiian health struggles were a central problem in Hawaiian society at this time. And so rather than just practicing medicine, a number of these foreign physicians take on roles in the in island politics, including eventually in the kingdom itself. They become very high important advisors to elite chiefs like Kamehameha, and actually have some of them almost have a kind of filibuster perspective or an approach as a filibuster. In fact, one German physician tries to take the island of Kauai. He's quickly kicked out by the head chief there. But so it's a indication of the importance of health problems at this time that these foreign physicians become so important to the chiefs.
Now, if possible, can you briefly comment on European perceptions of cultural decline among Hawaiians during the 1810s, particularly for ali'i patterns of consumption?
Yeah. For those scholars and readers who work in Native North American history, many will be familiar with the trope of the vanishing Indian, especially in the 19th century. The notion that that Native Americans were a doomed race or something along these lines, which of course was motivated more by manifest destiny and American empire than it was the facts on the ground. But in Hawaii, the fact that does matter is that the population declines precipitously. And everyone can see this because it's not the North American plains or the Arctic where it might be hard to track this. It's the Hawaiian Islands, which are very small islands, and it's not that difficult to run a census and see that the population is declining. That fact of population decline gets glossed by outsiders, Europeans and Americans, as cultural decline. In other words, that the Hawaiian culture is somehow diseased or doomed or deficient in some way. And there's no indication that Hawaiians feel this way. In fact, I question the very term cultural decline. It doesn't mean anything to me. I mean, what is it? Culture changes. That's in the nature of culture. But what does it mean for a culture to decline? Nothing, essentially. But it becomes a very important trope among outsiders, among Europeans and Americans about the Hawaiian people. And they connect a number of behaviors and social developments to this notion of decline. One is that Kamehameha's successor, Kamehameha does eventually conquer or unite the island chain, and this is the beginning of the Hawaiian kingdom in the early 1800s. He dies in 1819, and his successor, his son Liholiho, is judged by outsiders, but also by Hawaiians, as a less capable leader than his father, just simply less gifted in statecraft and less shrewd. So outsiders point to Liholiho as a symptom of this cultural decline. They also point to the new commodities that Hawaiians begin to consume. This includes alcohol and tobacco. Among the chiefs, it includes luxury goods such as silks, weapons, the acquisition of weapons. Outsiders point to the accumulation of debt, financial debt, among the chiefly class. Some scholars have questioned the reality of this debt. Was it more rhetoric or was it more reality? I believe it was reality, and I believe it's a it plays a major role in the imperial involvement in Hawaii, the fact that the chiefs take on significant debt. And finally, the outsiders point to the chiefs' exploitation, as they see it, of the commoners. Commoners, the term is maka ainana, people of the land. Outsiders are quick to write about the way the chiefs exploit commoners in forced labor, in various extractive industries that the islands begin to play host to. A narrative arises, a transnational narrative among Europeans and Americans, that the Hawaiian culture is declining, not just the population.
You've already touched on this. For our listeners, though, please briefly narrate the 1819 nullification of the kapu system of religious law after the death of Mo'i Kamehameha, focusing on the baptism of Chief Minister William Pitt Kalanimoku and his brother Boki, the causes of population decline, and the role of chiefesses in factionalism between the Maui chiefs and Big Island rebels. And then perhaps you can address what the impact was of the subsequent nullification.
Yeah, this is a big question.
Central question.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. And I take this on in chapter four. Kamehameha, the first king of the United Hawaiian Islands, dies in 1819. And shortly after his death, two of his widows, who are very high-ranked chiefs themselves, actually they outrank their husband, they outrank Kamehameha in island society. They lead what could be called a cultural revolution. And what they do is they nullify the system of religious law that had governed Hawaiian society for centuries. I call it religious law. It's essentially state religion. So Hawaii had a state religion, and it had a priestly class who was assigned to run that state religion. And they essentially, these two chiefesses, Ka'ahumanu and Keopuolani, they discard it. They officially discard it. And I argue, following the wonderful Hawaiian historian Lili Kala Kame'ilahiva, from the 1990s, I argue, as she did, that these two chiefesses were convinced that, as they said, a new way was required to bring new life to the nation. And I argue that new life, what they meant specifically, was improved health and survival. The impact of the Ma'i Malihini, the introduced diseases, the impact on fertility by the 1810s was dramatic. So women were struggling to bring births to full term. Their infant mortality was dramatic, was rising. And the chiefesses, at the same time that this was happening, were noticing that newcomers did not seem to be struggling as much. There weren't a lot of European and American families at this time living on the islands, but they could identify the differences in health outcomes, and especially in fertility. And so they suggested that the religious laws governing the islands needed to be discarded. And in Ka'ahumanu's terms, this comes secondhand to us from a white observer, but the observation that was recorded was that that she was going to choose to follow the lifestyle of the white people. Now, she was quick to point out that the Hawaiian people generally could continue to live however they wanted, but that she was going in the direction of white society. She wasn't specific on what this meant. But what's kind of amazing about this event on the Hawaiian Islands in 1819 is that there were no missionaries on the islands yet. Something similar, this is a much bigger transnational story in the Pacific in the 1820s, that the kapu system, in other places it's called the taboo system, religious law is jettisoned, and islanders take on Christianity essentially as its replacement. Replacement is too general a term. Religious life in many islands for many people is essentially unchanged. But the state religion is jettisoned by the leadership in exchange for Christianity. This happens all over the Pacific, but in most places there are missionaries in place when this happens. In most places, the nullification or the overthrow of the Kapu system is led by men. In Hawaii, there are two unique aspects that I think have been really underappreciated. The fact that there are no missionaries, so the fact that Hawaiians, elite Hawaiians are making this decision in the absence of Christianity, and that women are leading the charge. Chiefesses such as Ka'ahumanu and Keopuolani are leading the charge. They convince the monarch, Liholiho, who is Keopuolani's son, they convince him to dispense with the Kapu system and follow them into this new life, which as of 1819, it's unclear what that new life will be. So there are high-ranking chiefs who are the kinsmen of these two chiefesses who also follow them. This includes the chief minister, William Pitt Kalanimoku, and his brother, Boki, both of whom had been baptized by a visiting French priest the previous year. So I said there are no missionaries. There are no missionaries settled on the islands. In fact, all there are ship's priests, like this gentleman. So I point this out just because there were some precedents for the action of these two chiefesses. But nullification of the Kapu system was not tied in their minds, as far as we can tell, to the acceptance of Christianity. This act, the nullification of religious law across the islands, sparked a rebellion by traditionalists on the Big Island. And that rebellion is quickly put down by Kalanimoku, the chief minister in the kingdom. And essentially, there is a short period where anarchy is the wrong term, but a lot of Hawaiians are quoted by visitors as saying, you know, the old gods have been destroyed and there is no law at the moment. I think that's an overstatement, but there is this in-between period where it's unclear what kind of society Hawaii will be, what the role of the chiefs will be. And the impact of this nullification of the Kapu system, it's really hard to overestimate, because shortly, American missionaries do arrive and they find the ground, as they say, primed for possible Hawaiian conversion to Christianity, which ultimately does happen. But before conversion happens on a broad scale, what happens is a political alliance between the chiefs and the American missionaries. And I'm not the only person to argue that the nullification of the Kapu system did sort of prepare the ground for that alliance to occur.
So let's talk about the missionary program. How and why did proponents of the British New England missionary program, such as William Ellis and his Tahitian assistants, especially given the deaths of Ali'i in Hawaii and London, convince Kahumanu and island chiefs to support a missionary presence in Hawaii? Was there any dissidence against the Sandwich Islands missions?
Right. There, I mentioned the American missionaries who come from New England. They're mostly Congregationalists, Presbyterians. It's an interdenominational missionary program. This is, I think, the largest missionary program in the U.S. at the time. It's called the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, and they are all over the world. They come in 1820. They have two young men, young Hawaiian men, with them. These men had been educated at the Foreign Mission School in Connecticut. They had been Christianized, as far as we can tell, and they serve as kind of intermediaries to the mission. They introduce the missionaries to the Hawaiian chiefs and make their program, make their presence more acceptable at the start. The Hawaiian monarchs, including Ka'ahumanu, Liholiho, give the missionaries leave to stay on the island for 1 year. And they have only one condition for that leave to stay, which is that the physician who came with the missionaries would become Liholiho's personal physician. So the Hawaiian monarch gets to have this man as his personal physician, and the Ali'i are going to give them a test and see what these missionaries are all about. I should point out that the missionaries seem less threatening because they arrive with wives and children. I say wives because women could not be missionaries in the ABCFM, so it's just the men who are missionaries, and they bring their wives, they bring their children, and they're unarmed. So they don't seem like a threat to the chiefs at the start. Pretty shortly after they arrive, I believe the year is 1822, a British missionary organization arrives on the islands from Tahiti, so from the Society Islands in the South Pacific. And they have with them, there are three, I believe, three British missionaries from the London Missionary Society, and they bring with them Tahitian assistants. And these people are, these Tahitians are missionaries themselves. So there are two men, each of whom is accompanied by his wife. Other Tahitians had made their way up to the Hawaiian Islands by this point, and were serving as advisors to the Hawaiian chiefs. And some of these Tahitians, if not all of them, had become Christians because of the work of the London Missionary Society. So there hasn't been much attention paid to these Tahitian missionaries who arrived in 1822. Very little attention, actually. But I argue that they had a profound impact on the Hawaiian chiefs in terms of making Protestant Christianity and the missionary program, which was a total program of social change, really. Maybe we'll get into some of the expectations that Protestants brought to Hawaii in terms of how Hawaiians should live, but that the Tahitians made the Protestant program more palatable. And possibly, there's not a lot of evidence of this, but I looked hard for it, possibly convinced them of the health and reproductive benefits of Christianity. Hawaiians will decide on their own, independent of Tahitians, that Christianity, or I should say New England Protestantism, has health and reproductive benefits because the missionaries have enormous families, enormous relative to today. They have 10, 12, 14 children, where many Hawaiians are struggling to have any. And so Hawaiians pretty quickly see what they imagine are health benefits of the Protestant lifestyle, which also makes the movement more palatable. In terms of resistance, and so let me just finish on the note that Kaahumanu becomes the high chiefess. Kaahumanu becomes a leading proponent of the Protestants over the course of the late 1820s, early 1830s, and really makes their presence allows their presence to become more permanent. Allows these missionaries to become a more permanent presence on the island. There was dissidents. In particular, the Pele movement, which was centered on the Big Island. Pele was volcano goddess, and a number of local prophets sprung up, suggesting that Pele was unhappy with the arrival of the missionaries, unhappy with the Protestant mission, and essentially arguing for a traditional Hawaiian religious revitalization and removal of the foreign missionaries. But the Protestant chiefs, I'm not satisfied with that term, Protestant chiefs, but ultimately a lot of the chiefs do join forces with the Protestant mission and join the Protestant church. These people, led by Kaahumanu, ultimately win the battle for hearts and minds among elite Hawaiians, and encourage the Hawaiian people to follow their lead and join the Protestant church.
What was the Great Fatalism, and what does it have to do with the decision of many alii to join American Protestants and advocate for Christianity among the people?
Well, there's been a lot of scholarship on foreigners' views on the fate of Native people, especially in the 19th century, and how those might have affected Indigenous people's own ideas. But when I came to this project, I was really struck that no one had really wondered whether Indigenous attitudes about their lives and their futures had any effect on foreign impressions or attitudes about that. And so what I discovered reading closely in the documents, and especially Hawaiian language documents for this section, was that in the wake of the nullification of the Kapu system, the arrival of American and British missionaries, and the continuing health struggles unabated among Hawaiian people, elite and commoner, that there was a pervading mood of despair and actually of hopelessness among both ali'i and maka'ainana, among both elite and common Hawaiians, about the prospects for a Hawaiian future. This is particularly pronounced in the 1830s, and it's just all through the documents. Some scholars have treated this as just essentially missionary brainwashing, that, oh, Hawaiian people were being indoctrinated and taught to believe that they were a doomed race. But actually, I see it as almost the opposite, that this Hawaiian fatalism is sui generis. It's on the local level. It's coming from the people, and missionaries and other foreigners are echoing it. They're simply echoing it. And this fatalism, I argue, was the most important development that drove Hawaiians into the arms of the American Protestant mission. Other historians have referred to this moment in Hawaiian history as the Hawaiian Great Awakening, as riffing off the American two American Great Awakenings in the 18th and 19th century. But I suppose sort of cheekily suggest that we should think of it more as the Great Fatalism, because it was a mood of despair and hopelessness that drove Hawaiians into the Protestant camp, as opposed to a flurry of spiritual and revivalist activity. There is documented revivalist activity on the Big Island and Maui, but it's very short-lived. It's very localized, and it's temporary. People are Hawaiians in huge numbers leave the Protestant church. They turn to the Catholic church. Once Catholic priests are allowed on the islands, they become Mormons. They go back to Protestantism. They, as is true everywhere in Indigenous society, they continue to practice their own Indigenous religion and rituals. So the so-called Great Awakening, I don't dispute that there were revivals and that there was increased church membership, but I see the Great Fatalism as a much more pronounced and influential development. I should add that the ali'i especially were very canny in their acceptance of Christianity, and more than a few told visitors that they were only Christian so long as Christianity delivered for the people. And one of the things they meant, perhaps a central thing they meant when they said delivered, was that it was going to make their society thrive. It was going to make Hawaiian people more healthy. And it was going to improve conditions for the Hawaiian future. So I found a really wonderful conversation between a chiefess and a visiting, I believe it was a German delegation, who said, their Protestantism, that was fine for now, but they were only going to adhere to it as long as it worked. And then finally, just on this Great Fatalism, an important part of it, I argue, important part of this mood that pervades Hawaiian society at this time, is concerns over fertility, declining fertility, and the loss of family members. So virtually every every Hawaiian document I scanned from this period in the 1830s, people are mentioning the struggles to build families and the loss of their own family members. And so I argue that this really does feed into this mood of fatalism.
After establishment of the 1840 constitutional monarchy, how and why did gender, health, and mortality concerns intersect with the need to naturalize foreigners, this haole expansion of commercial agriculture, the chiefs' desire to preserve land, as well as the attempted regulation of sexual activities? I guess in the final analysis, who ultimately coordinated the mahele privatization of crown lands and why?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a big one. I'll try to be brief on this. The mahele was the privatization of lands across the islands that had been held officially and formally by the monarchy. This occurs in the late 1840s and early 1850s, and it has major consequences really across Hawaiian society. It allows foreigners to purchase land outright, to own it outright, as opposed to a kind of lease arrangement or a temporary usage of the land, with formal ownership being by the monarchy. So it allows that. It also sort of breaks the traditional bond between the ali'i and maka'ainana, between the chiefs and the commoners, because whether one sees the relationship as inherently exploitative or not, there was a system of tribute and there was a dependence going both ways between these classes, and the mahele essentially breaks that by making land private. It had three immediate causes that the mahele did, I argue, and I think I'm following other scholars in this. The naturalization of foreigners. This was important because foreigners, not just missionaries, began to arrive and settle in much greater numbers in the 1840s. We're still talking about thousands of people, low thousands rather than tens of thousands, but they became a problem, especially as they agitated for private property and political representation. So the kingdom felt the need to naturalize these people, in other words, make them subjects of the kingdom in order to control them, in order to prevent filibustering and imperial ambitions in these people. So that was one motivation, giving them a stake in Hawaiian society, essentially, by giving them, allowing them to buy property and have a voice in the government. It was secondly a concession to haole or foreign demands for private property. It won't surprise listeners to hear that Americans and British and other Europeans cared deeply about private property and believed it to be their inherent right, and had been for decades now making demands in published accounts back home, but also to the monarchy itself, that they needed private property in order to remain on the islands and feel in full, feel that their rights were being recognized in full. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, the chiefs at this point, the 1840s, were very worried about imperial ambitions of the European and American empires. And it's more or less the 1840s, a constant worry that some foreign power, some foreign empire is going to take the Hawaiian Islands by force. And that if that were to happen, the chiefs would lose everything, because the chiefs' wealth traditionally and in the 1840s was essentially land wealth. And if the islands were conquered, annexed, taken in some other kind of agreement, the chiefs would lose everything. And so in order to head that off, the chiefs saw land privatization as a possible solution. In other words, if they held lands individually, privately, they would not lose everything if the worst happened. In other words, conquest or annexation. The islands, at least once, there were French, British, and American attempts to take the islands in various ways during the 1840s. And at least once, the British do take the islands officially on paper, but the British monarchy doesn't accept the action of its I don't even recall if he's a delegate, and they give the islands back. But as I say, it's a constant concern of the monarchy, and the Hawaiian diplomats actually carry documents of annexation in case when they're visiting a foreign country or they're out at sea, in case something would happen that would require them to sign the islands over as a protectorate or something. So it's hard to underestimate that aspect of their motivation. The mastermind of this plan of land privatization, it was an American lawyer who becomes a judge on the islands. His name's William Little Lee. Surprisingly, Lee later defended Hawaiian sovereignty by adding a poison pill to a U.S. treaty of annexation. The U.S. tries to annex Hawaii multiple times over the course of the second half of the 19th century. And the way Lee does this is that he requires that Hawaiians would become full citizens if annexation were to happen, if the U.S. were to annex Hawaii, is that he added a clause that would require them to become full citizens. He knew that racist American legislators would never go for this, and in fact, they didn't. And so they rejected the treaty on this basis. So as a figure in this sort of imperial moment in Hawaiian history, William Little Lee has a mixed legacy, I think. He engineers the privatization of lands, which has incredible consequences for the Hawaiian people, but he also defends their sovereignty in that small way. The outcome of the Mahele is that the commoners, Hawaiian commoners, who make up probably 95% of the population in the 1840s, end up with about 1% of the land. The rest goes to kingdom officials, the monarchy, and white newcomers. And shortly after this, plantations, well, even simultaneously, plantations have been begun. And we're going to see a very different island society going forward. I'll just finally end on this point, on this question, that three epidemics strike the islands simultaneously with the Mahele, with the privatization of lands. And this really does not help the case against privatization, which many Hawaiians are making. They're writing entreaties to the monarchy saying, please don't let foreigners buy up our lands. It's going to be the death of us. They're going to run us off our ancestral lands. We can't survive without our land. The fact that Hawaii loses so many people at the very same time really doesn't help their case, because what happens is there's a perception on the part of the kingdom that agricultural production is down, that lands are laying fallow because tens of thousands of Hawaiians have died in the late 1840s as a result of these epidemics. So the case for privatization of lands and especially foreign ownership and development of lands becomes more attractive to the kingdom as a result of ongoing Hawaiian health struggles.
So do these epidemics and other epidemics in the late 1840s and 1850s facilitate the importation of Chinese and immigrant labor into the burgeoning Hawaiian plantation complex? And why, during this importation, did U.S. physicians advocate for Hawaiian intermarriage? Did their reasons adumbrate later Hawaiian immigration policy?
Absolutely, they did. In addition to the privatization of lands, the enormous costs in human life of the 1840s epidemics, the California Gold Rush begins in the late 1840s, and one of the Gold Rush is seen as an opportunity by the monarchy to supply gold miners and the enormous influx of people to California with produce, with agricultural produce. So this is another important pressure that the monarchy is feeling in terms of expanding Hawaiian agriculture. And their perception, in part, based on fact, is that the population is declining. It is declining. Let me just state it. The overall population is declining. And they're looking for labor. They're looking for people who can work the lands in order to supply California and a broader Pacific trade with agricultural produce. That story has been told broadly and for decades, all the way back to the, I'd say, 1930s. People have written about the land reform and the way the monarchy is thinking about opening up lands for private enterprise. What has not been discussed, and what I spend a lot of time thinking about in this final chapter of the book, is the way the monarchy is also thinking about, in their own terms, saving the Hawaiian race. In other words, they're looking for, the term they often use is cognate races. They're looking for people, whether Polynesians, other Pacific Islanders, who could not only supply agricultural labor for Hawaiian society, but intermarry with Hawaiians. And that's essentially what they do. They go on tours of the Pacific looking for Pacific Islanders and they eventually make it to East Asia, who could come and serve as a cheap labor force and be encouraged to stay and intermarry with Hawaiian women to bolster the population. This serves multiple purposes. A greater population means a greater labor force, of course, but they also, the monarchs and appointees, both white and Hawaiian in the monarchy, talk explicitly about bolstering the population through reproduction, through essentially mixed marriages. And so after looking around the Pacific, the monarchy decides that Asian labor would be a good option. And so the first Chinese contract laborers arrive in 1852, about 300 of them. And many do, in fact, stay and start families with Hawaiian women. And so that moment is pretty decisive in terms of the way the monarchy is thinking about Hawaiian society and the Hawaiian future. There will be, as scholars of the 20th century Hawaii know, there will be one group after another who serves as a labor force in Hawaii, Chinese, Korean, Portuguese, and many of those people stay and marry into Hawaiian families. I discuss also a U.S. physician named Luther Gulick, who was a son of one of the New England Protestant missionaries to Hawaii, because he writes extensively about labor policy and contract labor in a medical journal. The way he's thinking about that program is essentially, he believes that this is the best bet to save the Hawaiian race from extinction, is the term he uses. And he also believes that imported mixed marriages, imported laborers who marry with Hawaiian women, would raise the racial stock, as he calls it, of island society. So there's clearly a racialist motivation and thinking that's happening here. But what I was surprised about is that when I read the sources, the documents, was that the monarchy also seemed to believe that that depopulation could not be halted and would not be halted unless they imported people to bolster it. And so that ultimately is the plan going forward. This has typically been portrayed by scholars as American business interests, especially sugar planters, just looking for cheap labor and landing on Chinese and then moving on to Portuguese and Japanese and the rest. And that's not untrue, but it's also the case that the Hawaiian monarchy was deeply concerned about depopulation and believed that that the survival of the Hawaiian people would require importation of new people to marry in. I'll just finally note that the article by this physician is interesting in the context of U.S. empire, because a lot of the article is focused on what Hawaii could provide to the United States. And so he's publishing in the 1850s. The coup and annexation doesn't happen until the 1890s. So this is almost 40 years before. And he's thinking about all of the tropical agricultural productions that Hawaii could supply to the U.S. at the same time that he's thinking about saving the Hawaiian race and improving the racial stock, in his term. So yeah, I do see him, this physician, as prophetic, given the immigration patterns that played out in the later 19th century and really through the first half of the 20th century in Hawaii, and also prophetic in the role of U.S. empire in shaping the islands.
Thank you, Professor Archer. I have one final question. What can we expect from you next? Are you going on vacation, or is there any future projects that you can disclose at this time?
I can't commit to any, but I do have two projects in the conceptual phase, and so I'll just share those briefly with you. I haven't had a chance to do research on either of them, but I'm excited. I'm eager to. The first would be moving back to North America and thinking about the role of hunger and nutrition in shaping Native North America over the long term. So I come to this project with really just a hypothesis, which is that scholars Native communities often portray their foodways before colonialism as relatively stable and reliable, natural resources as being used efficiently, and of course there's abundant evidence that Native peoples across the Americas had had incredible resourcefulness and incredible resources that they knew how to use. But I think there's a tendency to overstate the reliability of natural resources, the predictability of things like climate, and other sort of day-to-day impacts on sustenance and nutrition. This is before colonial incursions happen. So I'm interested in maybe exploring, you know, in what ways was hunger and nutrition, what ways were they constant concerns, and in what ways did they shape Native life? So in what ways did they lead to migration, seeking out new trade works, trade networks, leading to raids or conflict with other Native peoples in the hundreds of years, a couple hundreds of years before the arrival of Europeans? And then on the flip side of it, on the colonial side, I also wonder if there's not a tendency to underestimate the impact of colonial incursions on Native subsistence, including agriculture, hunting and fishing, gathering, and the seasonal round. So I feel like for the colonial period, the historiography on Native North America is pretty good on colonial incursions like warfare, enslavement, certainly land expropriation, but it's much less developed on Native struggles to sustain healthy communities. And hunger and nutrition are central to that question. Finally, on this point, it doesn't take much reading in the literature on 18th and 19th century Native religious revitalization movements to see that hunger was central to many of them. So the ghost dance, the sun dance, we see in the oral traditions and in the documentary record many references to the role of hunger in leading to these movements. And so I think it's not just a question of nutrition. It's also a broader question of culture. And so I imagine that study, if it were to be done, I imagine it being on a broad canvas chronologically and also regionally, mostly just because this first book was so specific to a time and place. I'd like to do some more comparative work. The second idea I have for a project it's also about Native health. Imagine that, all three of these, but it's about Native health and Indian removal. So this would include the ways that North American empires, not just the U.S., but other empires in North America, deployed indigenous health struggles as a justification for ethnic cleansing. But beyond just the rhetoric and politics, I'm also interested in the kinds of data that may have been collected in Native communities. For instance, I'm thinking data in the broadest sense, by physicians, by Native medicine people or health workers and other informants. So what kinds of information were European and American and American empires, the administration of Andrew Jackson, say, what kinds of information were they collecting about Native health and the impact of contact with white settlers? And then in what ways did they use that to justify ethnic cleansing, essentially? Removal advocates made frequent reference to Native depopulation, population loss, and the opportunity that Natives would have, the so-called opportunity that Natives would have to flourish and recoup their numbers if only they could be removed from white settlers. And of course, that's a pretty transparent ploy or a smokescreen for genocide, really. But I'm curious how imperial agents' understanding of Native health and population played into these removal proposals. And I'm interested in how Native people themselves thought about the health of their communities and their well-being in their homelands, as opposed to in Indian territory or on reservations. There were obviously Native folks who agreed, at least on some level, that one of their major problems was contact with white settlers. And they also talk about health as being an aspect of that. So I'm interested in exploring that a little bit more.
All right. Thank you, Professor Archer, for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been really wonderful.
This is Ryan Tripp on behalf of Professor Archer, as well as the Native American Studies Channel at the New Books Network, signing off for today. Thanks for joining us.